Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
We maintain the peace through our strength. Weakness only invites aggression.
Trust but verify.
Well, I've said it before and I'll say it again. America's best days are yet to come.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Welcome to Reaganism, a podcast where we explore where the Reagan movement resides today. I'm Roger Zackheim, director of the Ronald Reagan Institute in Washington, D.C., and we have the good fortune of having Dr. Henry Olson for our podcast today. Henry is senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, where his work focuses on how America's political order is being upended by populist challenges from the left and right. Of course, he's an opinion columnist for the Washington Post. He's the author of two books, one of which is the subject of our conversation today, The Working Class Republican, Ronald Reagan and the Return of Blue-Collar Conservatism. Henry's also noted for his accuracy of electoral predictions in 2008, 10, 12, 14, 16, and 18, including identifying President Trump early in the 2016 race as the likely winner of the presidency. Henry has a BA from Claremont McKenna College and a GD from University of Chicago Law School, an encyclopedic knowledge of President Reagan, and particularly the connection between President Reagan and FDR. Hope you enjoy the cast. So the working class Republican, characterized by many reviewers or almost everyone as revisionist history, why did you write this book?
Well, I was a lifelong Republican. I started volunteering for the Republican Party 8 days before Richard Nixon resigned in 1974. And I grew up in California and was a conventional, semi-libertarian California conservative. And we get to, after spending a whole life in public life as a think tank person or running for office myself or running campaigns, we get to 2008. And it looks like everything I've been working for and we've been working for is history. That we're in the worst position that we've been in since 1978, before Reagan came to power. All the newspaper and magazine articles are talking about the New Deal. Remember that magazine where they've got Obama shopped in with the...
Obama's in office, you've lost the House 2 years prior. I mean, it's dark for conservatives.
Yeah, and not only lost the House, it's the seats. It's like we're to our lowest level since 1978 in the Senate, in the House. And it's like, this is dark. So I say, okay, well, Reagan got us out of it. Maybe I could learn something about how Reagan did it. And I started really reading Reagan instead of reading about Reagan. And it was a revelation. Hmm. It was a different man than I had learned about. And the more I studied him, the more I realized, wow, it's actually this different Reagan is how he could communicate with people who weren't already Republicans. And why the people who have been parroting the simplified Reagan haven't been able to do it. So that and the continued failure of the Republicans to make the needed adaptations made me say, I got to write this book. So, I got to bring this to the forefront, and hence the book.
So drill down a little bit more on that. Reagan won because he appealed to Reagan Democrats.
Right.
Your book says, well, it wasn't just he appealed to them. He had a conservative outlook philosophy, right? That the result was you got Reagan Democrats. Two questions. Give us a headline about that, because of course we'll talk more about what that philosophy is, which is captured in the book. And two, why did conservatives miss it? Like, why did this book have to wait until, you started writing it, what, in 2014, 2015?
Yeah.
It came out ahead of the, it was done before President Trump was elected.
Right.
I mean, that's quite a while. A lot of people were writing on Reagan beforehand.
Yeah. Well, basically, Reagan could communicate with what became the Reagan Democrats because he was a Reagan Democrat. He was somebody who started as a Democrat. He became a Republican, but he never left the reason he was a Democrat behind, and that was an overriding faith in the virtue and the dignity of the average individual. He loved liberty, but he loved human dignity more, and he loved human potential more. And that wasn't just for the great, it was for everybody. And that led him to create a new type of conservatism that they could buy into, as opposed to the old, more stagnant or uncaring or abstract conservatism that many had promoted.
So we'll drill down a bit on that and what that means from a policy standpoint,
yeah.
And perhaps how Republicans before and after have migrated away from it,
mm-hmm.
or never really had it. But you summarize the story as, this is the story of a man who, while lionized by the right and demonized by the left, and that's really not a controversial thing to say,
yeah.
transcended left and right.
Yeah.
And you're saying they transcended left and right not only for electoral success, but perhaps even as a political philosophy or as a matter of policy. Talk about the philosophy side and the policy side.
The policies flow from the philosophy, so you have to understand the philosophy first. You know, the fundamental argument between the left and the right in the 20th century was over government power. Should it be used or should it not be used? Government on the left was almost always saying yes, virtually any problem could be met with a centralized government solution. The right, the real conservative right, not the go-along, get-along right, was almost always saying no, and often saying that we should remove the powers that have already been granted in the intervening period. And Reagan thought that was an irrelevant question. It wasn't that he didn't suspect government power, but for him the question was, who controls it and to what ends is it used? Is it used by people to help advance their own freedom and dignity, or is it used by others to suppress that? And that meant that Reagan had this ability to literally transcend in the left and right because he changed the nature of the question and the American people responded. And then the policies flow from that philosophy.
Well, and I think some of those policies, I mean, you admit in the book that it's unclear, at least for today's challenges, what particular policy Reagan would pursue. You know, yes, you say he would be against Obamacare, but what would be the replacement, for example, is one thing you've written. So we could talk about that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it seemed to me that one of your aha moments that got you at that, the conclusion or the thesis of this book, was on a day you met with a man named Alan Alameda.
Yeah.
Tell me about that and how it drove you to recognize kind of this, what you believe was Reagan's philosophy.
Yeah, well, I was a young 24-year-old running for the only time I've run for office in California, and I'm going to raise money, and I go meet with a funeral director named Alan Alameda. And I'm doing my, saying what any young conservative, libertarian-oriented conservative would talk about, cutting taxes, cutting government. And he says to me, well, what would you cut? And I was stumped because it was all an abstract to me. It was all government, you know. All this stuff fit under government. It wasn't discrete things. And I realized then...
You should have known Nick Mulvaney, because I'm pretty sure Mulvaney would have given you a list of things to be cut right away, right? I mean...
Well, yes, but that actually gets to the question. Right. That is that it led me to understand that in order to know what was out, I had to know what was in and why. And so that meant that a simple libertarian perspective wasn't sufficient. It wasn't right. But I was not yet mature enough to have adopted this, to know what should be in and why. And my reading of Reagan really have taught me what should be in and why. So now I could answer Alan's question. Unfortunately, he passed away a few years ago.
And Reagan, of course, got that in part because of what he saw during the New Deal era.
That's right. Well, and that growing up, that Reagan grew up with staunch Democratic parents. He was the product of what would have been, for the time, a mixed marriage, Catholic and Protestant. And so he experienced discrimination of Protestant children who would make fun of his Catholic father. And staunchly believed, as his parents did, that the Democrats were the party of the working man and the Republicans were the party of the business elites. So as he matured and as he saw that the Democratic Party in operation was actually the party of other elites, he never lost that core sense. So that meant he always had a sense of what should be in and what should be out on a very moral level, which confused hardcore libertarians like David Stockman, who I write about in the book, never understood him because he listened to the anti-government part of Reagan's speech and thought, well, he agrees with me, when he never listened to the nuances.
And then after your discussion, Mr. Alameda, you really succinctly put what that philosophy is, which, of course, the policies grow out, and you say it's like four things. Yeah. Supportive for programs that actually help people who truly needed help to live, here's those words again, decent, dignified lives.
Yeah.
Opposition to programs that either did not fit that requirement or that forced people to live in a way they did not want as a condition of getting the help. And those kind of two or three components really drove it.
Yeah. Well, I think that drove Reagan's philosophy, and through Reagan, it drives my philosophy today. And I think it's where Americans are at. But you take a look at Reagan's speech. Reagan was not somebody who talked or thought in the way college professors. He doesn't say, here's my principle A and therefore B. He's an inductive thinker and speaker, so you have to tease out the principles. His speeches are like an onion, where each there's a layer under a layer under a layer. And when you read it that way, you realize it's really tightly constructed and highly principled. And for Reagan, the idea of human need was absolutely central. If you needed something, not wanted something, desired something, hoped for, but if you needed something, if you needed food, if you needed shelter, if you needed education, It was our obligation to provide it and not necessarily rely on voluntary means to do it, which was the Goldwater, the anti-New Deal solution. But if you didn't need it, and this is why he always focused on helping the poor but not helping other sorts of people and drawing back those sorts of programs, it was not right to tax other people for that. And that subtle distinction transcends left and right and sits where I think most Americans were then and are today.
Of course, that articulation drives, let's say, the conventional reading of Reagan crazy. Because, you know, they think about, you know, one of the scariest words, you know, you can hear is, I'm here from the, you know, I'm from the government, here to help.
Right.
Right? And what you're essentially saying is, actually, President Reagan, as a core philosophical tenet, believe government should help and can help.
Yes.
For those needs.
Yes. And that's the thing, is it depends on what they're doing and how they're doing. What Reagan always objected to in his conservative phase was the idea that government should be the first and best and only solution.
Mm-hmm.
So to that extent, the idea, what he's trying to say in those words is, you're not a dependent. You shouldn't just look and say, the government is here to run your life. But rather, if you needed help, the government could and should help you. And that's why he supported tax increases when he was governor. He supported health program extensions when he was president. He said, I have quotes from him going from 1961 all the way through his life, saying that he supported the idea that no one should be denied health care because of a lack of funds in America. And that included government programs, as many, you know, both examples of things he proposed and things he supported. This is a very distinct feature of Reagan, and that's something that the libertarian hagiographic right wants to forget. Go back to the key moment in the 1980 debate that everyone likes to quote, where he goes to Jimmy Carter and says, there you go again, which just typified the way he was being hectored. But what it was about was Reagan being called on the carpet by Carter saying, you opposed Medicare. And what Reagan says, there you go again.
There you go again. When I opposed Medicare, there was another piece of legislation meeting the same problem before the Congress. I happened to favor the other piece of legislation and thought that it would be better for the senior citizens and provide better care than the one that was finally passed. I was not opposing the principle of providing care for them. I was opposing one piece of legislation.
What he says to Carter is he opposed Medicare because he was in favor of another program, which is, he didn't remember in 1980, it was called the Kerr-Mills Act, and I've discovered that in my research. He was never opposed to the principle of providing help. He was never opposed to the principle of the federal government taxing and spending to help needy seniors pay for their medical care. That's what Reagan said in 1980, and it won him the presidency.
It's interesting. I don't know if you saw Peggy Noonan, who, of course, famed speechwriter in the Reagan White House and, of course, trustee of the Reagan Foundation. Recently, Early May wrote an opinion piece in her declarations, Republicans and a Nation Needing Repair. And it tracks a lot with what you, the way you describe Reagan's philosophy. Interestingly, she doesn't channel President Reagan, but basically says, Republicans, you need to ask the questions, what would a large government harnessed toward conservative ends look like?
Yeah.
And recognizing that a conservative path would address the immediate crises Americans on the ground still see all around them, highlighting many of these things that Americans view as needs today. I was just curious if you saw that and, you know, if you thought that somewhat aligned with the outlook that you bring out in your book.
I did, and it does. I mean, you should never try and proclaim ownership of a late historical figure. So I'm not going to say Ronald Reagan would agree with all seven of Peggy Noonan's points. But Ronald Reagan always was concerned with helping Americans. And yes, he believed that less government was generally the way to do it. But I think in the present circumstances, to turn the words of his first inaugural on its head, he may not say that government is the problem, but he might think that some government was the solution. Much as he did in his presidency when he imposed tariffs or quotas on Japanese imports at least four times in order to protect American workers from unfair Japanese competition.
So let's migrate a bit and get into a little bit more of the of how your book and your thesis really runs counter to the, you know, kind of conventional, a general understanding of President Reagan, and particularly the evidence that you had kind of had to surmount or explain away. And two really stand out. The Reason Magazine interview in 1975, where President Reagan says, listen, conservatism equals
Yeah, the heart and soul of conservatism is libertarianism, is, I believe, the quote.
So that's kind of his explanation of conservatives and libertarians. And the second is in 1976, he says fascism was really the basis of the New Deal.
Yeah.
So explain to us how you work around some of those pretty clear statements from President Reagan himself.
Yeah, well, the first one is pretty easy to do because what I have is a number of pages in the book where I examine each of the arguments in detail that he had with his interlocutor, Manny Klausner, who's a friend of mine. And I showed my essay to Manny before I printed it to make sure, hey, did I miss anything? Am I mischaracterizing something? And whether he agreed or disagreed with what Reagan said, he thought that was a fair treatment of it. And that is, whenever the libertarian interviewer tried to press Reagan, he did not give the libertarian answer. He, for example, with the FDA, he thought the FDA, which Klausner was trying to get him to say was improper because it was taking away power from consumers. Reagan says, no, we actually need something like that to protect us. Motorcycle helmets. Reagan is torn on this, you know, that on the one hand, there's a social obligation for freedom. People should be able to ride without helmets. But when it comes to the fact that their insurance cost imposes costs on us, shouldn't we have a right to tell them or to require them to wear helmets?
Are we going to hear Mayor Bloomberg say that Reagan would have been for restricting Big Gulps? Is that where you're going?
No, that's not where I'm going.
The public health cost, too much sugar.
I think Reagan would have probably come down on the side of freedom on that. But the point is, it wouldn't have been a simple thing. He actually had a principle. And in the Reason interview, time and time again, I show on question after question, he was pushed to a libertarian conclusion, and he stood away from it on very principled grounds, precisely in the idea that government has an obligation to provide services and provide help for people who need it, and that he had a faith in democratic government that pure libertarians don't have. And I have a couple of pages where I bring that up.
So that does a nice job of explaining the Reason magazine interview and the departure from pure libertarianism.
Right.
What about the argument that Reagan departed from his New Deal identity as captured in what he said in 1976?
Yeah.
Fascism is essentially
the thing is, I think
New Deal.
Yeah, I think the thing to remember is that the New Deal had different parts. There was the New Deal that tried to control and harness the American economy, much of that struck down by the Supreme Court by 1935. And there was the New Deal that endured, which is the social insurance part. Reagan never rejects the social insurance part, ever.
Which is, he refers to as a social safety net?
Right. What he refers to as a social safety net is what most people think of when they think of the New Deal. They think of Social Security, which was a New Deal program. Reagan was always for Social Security. He said he was endorsed Social Security in Time for Choosing, and in many of his private letters, he elaborated on that and talked about even how Social Security should go for people who need it, but not for people who don't. In fact, he didn't take Social Security.
But how's that different than Paul Ryan, who we'll get to in a little bit? Hmm. But Paul Ryan didn't seek to remove Social Security. Perhaps in his heart of hearts, I don't know what he truly believes about it, but
right.
No conservative today would say, let's end that program. It's all about, all right, maybe we got to delay the kick-in period or bend the cost curve a little bit.
Yeah.
But they all recognize that, yes, there's a social safety net requirement. So how is Reagan's approach to that different than kind of where conservatives are today with respect to Social Security?
Yeah, well, I think part of it is that because Reagan genuinely believed in the need, Reagan always thought of the benefits first and the cost second. Whereas Republicans, particularly libertarian-oriented Republicans, who may be uneasy with the idea but recognize they can't say anything, inevitably make arguments that demonstrate to the average American that they don't really care about the program, that they care more about cost or abstract freedom than they do about the security. And that's the biggest reason why Republicans, I believe, are not trusted to reform entitlements, whether they be Medicare, Medicaid, or Social Security, because at heart, people value the security first, and cost and liberty come second.
And then, of course, you have the 1982 diary entry, which reinforces your thesis. But Parsons...
Then the 1982 diary entry, where he says that he's not trying to overturn the New Deal, that he voted for Franklin Roosevelt four times.
Right.
Right.
But he parses New Deal from Great Society.
Exactly. And that's something that Reagan did very quickly at the outset of the Great Society. In fact, one of the great underappreciated speeches of Reagan was his 1966 speech when he's running for governor, called the Creative Society, which was his attempt to create an alternative to the Great Society. Read that speech, because what it is a pan to freedom, but not libertarianism. In fact, he at one point says that government's not going to be standing by the side like a good Samaritan, just handing out medals for good conduct, that there's a role for government, but it's not the answer to all our problems. And so Reagan's creative society, even when he's distinguishing it from the Great Society.
Which is published in a book, right?
His speech became part of a collection of his speeches that was marketed as the Creative Society.
Right.
That was his gubernatorial era speeches that became marketed as a book named after his landmark speech delivered in 1966. And that just shows that Reagan was always a different type of conservative. He was never the... I'm here to repeal government. I'm here to take down laws, not to pass them, which is a paraphrase of Barry Goldwater's famous quote. He wanted less government, but he wanted a government that was controlled by the people and for the people. And that included much more government than people on the right at the time or today seem to want themselves.
I want to go deeper into Republicans today, and particularly your treatment of Paul Ryan and some of the distinctions you made. But before we get there, you were just making this distinction between Reagan's notion of freedom and libertarianism.
Yes.
Say a little bit more about that, because you read Reagan and anything, domestic policy, foreign policy, I mean, you name it, ag policy, it's the word freedom is like never more than a sentence or two away from whatever he's talking about.
Just take Reagan loved human freedom. I mean, I'm not trying to say that he's not somebody who loves human freedom, but he loves human freedom in the context of human dignity. I think there's one quote that kind of summarizes. If you go to An American Life at the beginning, he says, it's in one of the early pages, he says something...
Which is, of course, his autobiography.
I'm sorry, yes, his autobiography, his final autobiography.
Right.
His first autobiography was 1965, Here's the Rest of Me, after a line of his from a movie. But what I consider the authoritative autobiography, the 1989 one, is in American Life. And he says, paraphrasing, that the thing that's always bothered me most is the attempt to take away from people their democratic rights, whether by a government or by an employer. Think about those last words, by an employer. What libertarian conservative could say that a free transaction between an employer and an employee could ever deprive the employee of their democratic rights? But a Rooseveltian could say that.
Or
a Reaganite conservative.
Somebody who leads a workers' union.
And Ronald Reagan opposed right to work for most of his life because he was strong. He actually talks about that when he got to Hollywood, he did not believe in compulsory unionism. And then he saw how the bosses were pushing around the contract players and the workers, and he became a staunch advocate of unionism and actually opposed right to work when he ran for governor and wrote a letter which is in the private letter collection in 1970 to the head of the Right to Work Association explaining why he opposed it. It's precisely that balance between liberty and dignity that strikes Reagan conservatism that is often too lacking in Ryan conservatism or Goldwater conservatism or any sort of conservatisms that claim lineage from Reagan but leave out the key element.
So let's delve into the Reagan and Ryan's Republican Party. And you make a distinction as you address this. You kind of have your Ryan 1.0 and then you talk about the Ryan 2.0
right.
Kind of before and after.
Before and after he gets power. You've got
right.
Ryan when he's a backbencher and then Ryan after he becomes famous.
And of course 2012... was this period where he's on the ticket with Romney and what kind of his takeaways, or at least the way you present it,
yeah.
And how that impacts his outlook as speaker. But you essentially, the way I read it, is that you have kind of two paradigms, which is the Reagan paradigm of cares about people like me,
yeah.
And then the paradigm of the 2012 Republican convention, which is we built this.
Yeah.
Talk about those two.
Yeah, we built this. Those of us who remember the 2012 convention, Obama had said, talked about entrepreneurs or business people saying, you say you built it, you didn't build it. You had help from, this or that or that. And the Romney campaign seized on it, said, no, we built this. It's us. And there was this deification of the entrepreneur, of the business person, that I think exemplifies supply side thinking, which is that the 1 or 2% of the people who are motivated and capable of being extreme entrepreneurs are kind of the best among us. And they're the ones who create everything, and we kind of follow in their wake.
Well, it'll trickle down to us, and we'll benefit.
Well, that's where trickle-down economics comes from, is, free the 1 or 2%, and, they shall create bountiful piles of gold that will trickle down to all the rest of us. But there's a moral statement at that. The moral statement is they're better than you, so you should let them run free, and whatever they do is something that's just. And that was completely against Ronald Reagan's philosophy. Reagan never adopted it. I've listened to all of his speeches or read all of his speeches, and Reagan's philosophy was not opposed to the businessman, it was for the dignity of the average person. He talks about the average person being the driver of the economy. He's for what we would now call supply-side economics, lower the rate, broaden the base, mm-hmm. as early as 1957. But he always presents it to his audience not as unleashing the top, but as empowering the middle, empowering the average. And that gets to cares about people like me. That for Reagan, caring about the average person was why he became a conservative. It was not a byproduct mm-hmm. of adopting tenets of conservatism. And in the 2012 campaign, there was an exit poll. And the exit poll asked, which of four characteristics is most important to you as a president? And 78% of people chose three of the four. And Romney won each of those by between 9 and 23 points. So you think 78%, average victory margin of 13 points, Romney should be president. He loses because about 18% choose the fourth category, and he loses that 81 to 18, 63 points, and that category was cares about people like me. And that is a test that Ronald Reagan did not fail. He passed it, and it is a problem that Republican candidates continually have because they haven't adopted the core element of Reaganism.
One more question on that, and then we'll get to the ever popular kind of, the reason why your book got the attention of so many was Reaganism and Trump populism. You have a line in there where you say, cares about people like me that even Ryan 2.0 only captured cares about people.
Yeah.
But Republicans, and you're using Ryan, I think, as just a way to talk about Republicans at large, that they haven't really internalized the like me part until you get to President Trump.
That's
just to add to that a little bit.
Yeah. So what happens after 2012 is, Ryan has become a national figure by advancing libertarian conservative policies. And he's on the ticket where Romney essentially echoes that idea. They expect to win, they lose. So Ryan goes into this introspective period and comes out saying, we need to have...
Travels the country. Listening tour.
He's not the speaker at this point. He basically goes underground for you. And then he comes out with a new Ryan 2.0 policy that's designed to attack poverty. And that shows he gets the part of caring. But the reason he lost was because working class people who didn't like Obama, people who were above the poverty line but not into the upper middle class, didn't trust the Romney-Ryan ticket. So the whole question of cares about people is not relevant to them. What they want to know is, do you care about me? Do you care about people like me? And I call it in the book the truckers and cashiers test, because mm-hmm. the job that a non-college educated male is most likely to have is driving a truck, whether it's a big rig or a FedEx or a mm-hmm. postal service. For a woman, it's either a cashier or some sort of medical secretary. And my question is, when you're a Republican or you're a conservative and you're talking, imagine that person is listening to you on the radio. Is there something that you are saying that will directly resonate to the challenges they face so that they believe that you care about them? Most Republicans fail. Reagan succeeded and Trump succeeded.
Hard to advocate for TPP, right? The Trans-Pacific Partnership, and say it's caring about people like the trucker or the cashier. You
know. Right, because as we know, too many people have viewed the demise of the manual laborer and the economic pressures that have been put on people with less education as the natural byproduct of a free economy. And if that means wealth flows to India and to the coast and your life and your community is upended, well, tough patooties. That's just what the laws of economics dictate. And that's not what people want.
Tough patootie is not a Reagan quote, is it?
No, it's not. I'm afraid that's an adaptation of mine. it's a kinder, gentler version of what I would have said. But
For this family show,
exactly.
But you know, you actually just hit on a point, and I'll do a plug for an article by a colleague of yours in National Affairs, Orrin Cass, at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, which really hits this point mm-hmm. about how conservatives, for the most part, have embraced this dynamism and you know, you talk about this investor class or praise for the entrepreneurs and free trade, and ultimately you can't convince, first, certainly the working class, that's helping them, but B, ultimately, it's not even good for the investor class itself. So a quick plug, quite departure
Orrin is
from
a great
the focus.
Thinker.
Last thing on the Ryan and kind of Republicans in the last decade or so, we had Speaker Ryan inaugurate the Reagan Institute, which is, of course, where we do this podcast. And here's a quote from his speech.
Ronald Reagan charted the right course. It's peace through strength, pro-growth economics, clear moral leadership. It's not a new or a magic formula. What is needed is a new willingness to think big, to go bold, and to see things through.
What is he missing in that, what he outlined as a Reagan kind of course?
Two things he's missing. One, it's not a formula. He's treating this as a cookie cutter approach. Add a little sugar, add a little bake, put it in the oven. Whoa, electoral and national prosperity. That's not what Reagan was selling. So the idea that it's a tripartite formula is not Reagan's philosophy, not what Reagan's legacy was. Secondly, what most important that he misses is the dignity and the power of the average person. That what Reagan always emphasized, listen to Time for Choosing. Time for Choosing is an appeal to the average American to take back their country and their legacy and run their lives. He actually says that some will tell you that this is about, you know, this election is about left versus right. I'm here to tell you there is no such thing as left versus right.
You and I are told increasingly we have to choose between a left or right. Well, I'd like to suggest there is no such thing as a left or right. There's only an up or down. Man's old age dream, the ultimate in individual freedom consistent with law and order, or down to the ant heap of totalitarianism.
So let's move to 2016. Uh-huh. And of course, you called it earlier than others. You know, you've been pretty effective at calling elections.
10:45 Eastern. I beat the networks by 4 hours.
There we go.
I do it on Twitter.
So it's there. The evidence is there.
Oh, yeah. The evidence is there.
Trump, of course, is the first Republican since Reagan to get something like a Reagan Democrat. You know, for Reagan, it was the Reagan Revolution. For Trump, there's this kind of populist element, which is an analog or kind of somehow rhymes with that. So it's not just about policy,
right?
But it's a way of speaking to that, to those people. Just give me your riff on Reagan and Trump, same and different, and kind of what is 2016 really 1980?
Yeah, it's a little bit yes and a little bit no, but more yes than no. If you take a look at American politics, the non-evangelical, non-college-educated white who tends to live in the north, in the Midwest, in the Mid-Atlantic states, the Catholic, the Lutheran, the Swedes, the Norwegians, the Finns, the Germans, they did not vote for Barry Goldwater. They were very lukewarm to Richard Nixon. They loved Ronald Reagan, and then they moved away from the Republican Party until Donald Trump. And they are why Donald Trump is president. And so what do they...
Or three counties in that area is why Donald Trump is president.
Well, it's not three counties. It's amazing when you look at the more you look, the more amazing you find it. You know, like I've looked at counties. There's a county in Kentucky that was founded in 1869, had never voted for a Republican for president until 2016. There's counties in Iowa where manufacturing left to foreign competition that gave Trump the biggest margin since at least 1956, and in some cases back to 1928. You're talking about historic things that were happening. People have yet to appreciate how massive this was. Basically, what Trump does is do what Reagan did, which is come in and say, you're Americans too. You're being left behind by an elite that doesn't care about you. They care about somebody else. And your jobs, your lives, your community are what make America great. And I'm going to make America great again because I'm going to make you great.
Why is that not just populism? Why is that Reaganism in your mind?
Populism usually carries with it a demagogic element and an unserious element and often a hostile element that seeks not just to empower the people, but to disempower, you know, an elite, not just by kicking them out of office, but like restricting their rights and so forth. That's not what Trump was about, and that's not what Reagan was about. Reagan was a populist in many ways, and Reagan hit on themes that no other Republican, no other conservative was talking about. And he was the first person who discovered the power of the welfare issue. He's in 1965, 64, he's talking about it in his speeches. In 1965 and 66, he discovers the power of the cultural unrest at Berkeley, where no other Republican is getting that parents are upset that their kids are going to college and they might be deprived of the opportunity to learn because of a bunch of radicals doing sit-ins and throwing rocks. He understands that there's more to life than a balance sheet or tax rates. dignity. It's the opportunity to advance that allows him to be populist in that way. And so, to me, you take a look at what Trump did. It's not a coincidence that Trump has a similar theme, has a similar approach, and gets similar results. Now, the fact is they're hugely different in temperament, and Trump is nowhere near as optimistic and inclusive as he should be, and that's keeping him from building a Reagan-like coalition.
I want to pursue that point because I think the contrast is so stark. That's not even making a judgment about President Trump. It's just the contrast couldn't be starker.
Right.
Are you simply saying it's just a difference in tone? I think Reaganism ultimately, in its essence, is the way he left office, which is I appealed to your best hopes, not your worst fears, right? That this is this positive vision of America, that the essence of it was a newfound patriotism. I think in Reagan's own words, he reflects upon his time in office as those being the very important core elements, that's decidedly not Trump's outlook.
No. Trump focuses on the negative. He focuses on the enemies, and he does not build a rhetorical city on a hill. For Reagan, going back to his early speeches when he was still a Democrat, it was always about the city on a hill. It was always about if there's a problem, it's not because America is flawed, it's because America can be better. And there's a sense of that in Trump, but that's not his emphasis. And part of it also, frankly, is for Reagan was somebody who didn't care where you came from as long as you accepted American ideals. And so Reagan could be in favor, as he was in private letters, of some form of immigration restriction, because, as he said, if we had let anyone come here for economic reasons, we'd be overrun. There's no way we could satisfy everybody. So he was always for that balance, but he loved immigrants. And let's face it, Trump has not expressed a similar affection.
We'll leave it at that on the immigration point.
Well, the fact is some of those things, what Reagan was able to do, in one of my post 2018 pieces, I talked about the coalition of being rhinos, tigers, and elephants. Elephants is your core Republican. There's lots of types of core Republicans, but they're basically core Republicans. And tigers are the blue-collar voters, who I gave them an animal name. Trump is great Republicans.
Why'd you select tiger for them?
Because people have been attacking, the conservatives have been attacking moderate Republicans as rhinos, Republican name only. So I thought, okay, what I'm trying to do in the piece is say, look, guess what? You wanted the rhinos out of the party all this time. They left, and you lost the House because you needed the rhinos. But the thing is that the Romney Party, the Ryan Party, was basically rhinos and elephants and left out the blue-collar voters.
Yeah.
And I gave them an animal name to be funny and fun. But Trump is great Republicans, T-I-G-R-S, tigers.
We'll have that in the notes. I missed that one. That's great.
Yeah, so the Romney Party was elephants and rhinos. And the Trump Party is tigers and elephants, but you need all three. And Reagan got all three together. He got moderates who liked George Bush or voted for John Anderson to stay Republican. Mm-hmm. And he got the people who voted for Hubert Humphrey over Richard Nixon to join the Republicans. And he kept all the Republicans in place. That's what created the Reagan coalition. And that's what we don't have
that
today.
We're going to move on to 2020 and then we'll get to our lightning round. But just to close out on the discussion of the book, well, you've just said the Reagan coalition has been said before. You do the kind of post-election analysis and you see those constituent pieces. What is so interesting and provocative about your book is to say that in those three groups, let's make sure I get the animals right, the elephants, the rhinos, and the tigers, Reagan, in his essence, was more of a tiger than he was a rhino or an elephant.
Yep. And in a sense, Trump, who also is not a historic Republican, is more of a tiger than a rhino or an elephant, and that's a secret of his success.
The difference between it is that rhinos and elephants, well, we've really gone astray here, but rhinos and elephants...
Let's have an animal stampede.
Right. Rhinos and elephants claim Reagan. We're not yet at the point where rhinos and elephants are claiming Trump. And that's what makes your book...
Well,
your
rhinos are rejecting Trump, and elephants are split between claiming him and being uneasy with him.
2020 election. Of course, you're known for the accuracy of your predictions, and it's a fascinating field of Democrats.
Yeah.
I want to jump into this by getting at something we just discussed, which is the electorate and then different pieces and elements of the electorate, and particularly the element we call the Reagan Democrats. I recently heard Mayor Pete, of course, is the mayor in South Bend, Indiana. Of course, I'm happy we can call Mayor Pete because then you don't have to trip him pronouncing his last name.
Exactly.
And he described the county where South Bend sits as having voted for, let me get this right, Obama, Trump, Pence, and Mayor Pete. Because, of course, it's Indiana, so the Indiana had voted for Pence. So the same electorate voted for these four very different candidates. Mm-hmm. To which interviewer asked, well, are you saying the voter's fickle? And his response is like, no, I think that the commentariat is lazy and lacks the imagination or understanding to come up with new categories other than left, right, liberal, conservative, Republican, right. Democrat. And his county reflects that. Yeah. And he's somebody who says, and I'm able to win in a place where Trump won and Pence won. I like your riff or your take on that, because I feel like you're capturing something similar in your understanding of Reagan.
Yeah, I mean, let's be fair, is that St. Joseph's County includes more than South Bend, and Mayor Pete's never run countywide, so he's won the city, that's the Democratic heart of a less, so he's fudging the facts a little, but he's absolutely right. Is that the reason Trump is president?
It's still Obama and Trump.
That's my point. That's what I'm trying to get at. Right. Let's distinguish Mayor Pete's selective reading of the fact and get to the fact, which is, yes, the reason Trump is president is because of Obama-Trump voters, millions of them. I don't think that they are fickle. I think that they want something that neither party has been offering them. They want a continuation of... My argument is that Reagan offered an interpretation and a continuation of the New Deal, not its rejection, and people would like more of that. But what they've been offered since Reagan is a Republican Party that's moving off into abstractions about liberty and cost, and a Democratic Party that's moving into abstractions of socialism or government control and equality, and they want what they had, which is a government that cares about average people, helps them meet their needs, and then gets the heck out of the way. So they thought they were going to get it with Obama. Obama disappointed them. They thought they were going to get it with Trump. So far, I think the jury's out. I think a lot of people are sticking with them more than the commentariat wants to agree.
Lightning round.
Okay.
Ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Favorite book on Reagan other than your own?
Other than mine. Early Reagan by Ann Edwards.
Favorite speech?
1977 speech to CPAC.
Favorite Reagan quote?
His epitaph. I know in my heart that man is good, that right will eventually triumph, and that there's worth and purpose to each and every human life.
Henry Olson, thank you so much for being with us here on the Reaganism Podcast. Look forward to having you back.
Thanks for having me on.